Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. How similar to themselves do parents expect their sons and daughters to be, and what happens when children define themselves based on characteristics their parents do not share? Those questions are common to families that might seem to have little in common with one another. Those raising children with deafness, dwarfism, transgender identity, or intellectual disabilities, or even prodigy-level gifts. Yet each family must find its own path for coping with those differences, which lies somewhere between simply accepting their kids for who they are and trying to help them fit in with the rest of the world. Andrew Solomon is a lecturer in psychology at Cornell University and special advisor on LGBT affairs to the Department of Psychiatry at Yale. His new book is called Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew, welcome to Think.
What a pleasure to be here.
So at the heart of this book really is the issue of vertical versus horizontal identities. Can you talk about what those are?
Sure. So I defined identities as falling into one of two categories. Vertical identities are the ones that are passed down from generation to generation. So your ethnicity is usually a vertical identity. Your nationality, your language, often your religion. These are things parents have in common with their children. And even though some of them present difficulties, they're things parents tend to give a positive notion of to their children. They reinforce them in constructive ways. Horizontal identities are identities that occur when a child has a quality that he does not have in common with his parents. So gay children of straight parents, deaf children of hearing parents, dwarfs born to parents of average height, people who are transgender born to parents who are comfortable and happy in the gender they were born in. In these cases, the child has something that is signally and specifically different from the parents, doesn't get that reinforced usually by the parents, who are often uncomfortable with the condition or want to fix or cure it, and then at some point discover a peer group with whom they have this thing in common. And so because they're learning from peers rather than from parents, I've called it a horizontal identity. It's their own generation that teaches them how to live that identity.
And as soon as these parents make these differences make themselves apparent, parents really do have that question of whether this is a flaw or something they're going to accept. And the difference is not always clear cut.
It's very confusing a lot of the time. I've said that for all of the subjects I looked at, all of the conditions I've reviewed in the book, that they can be experienced either as an illness or as an identity. And I think, in fact, almost anything contains some elements of illness, some ways in which it constrains you from other things that you might wish or want to do, and some elements of identity, some way in which having a condition ends up defining who you are. What parents have to figure out when they're looking at their kids is what is actually fixable and what is not fixable, and what is it desirable to fix and what is it better to leave alone. It comes down to that old serenity prayer. I need to fix what I can, accept what I can't, and have the wisdom to know the difference.
And I was really fascinated that you started thinking about this 20 years ago when you wrote an article for the New York Times, was it, about deaf culture?
Right. So my editors at the Times asked me to do this story, and I was kind of surprised because I'd mostly been doing international reporting up until that time. And my editor said to me, I think that this is a foreign society within our own and that you might be able to penetrate it and get a feeling for it the way you have in foreign places. And that was really true. I set out thinking deafness was an obvious deficit. People who can't hear wouldn't be able to listen to you on the radio, wouldn't be able to do all kinds of other things. It was nothing but a disadvantage. And then I discovered the deaf world. I went to deaf social clubs. I went to the Miss Deaf America contest, which was quite something. I went to see deaf theater. I listened to, or rather watched, the performance of deaf poetry. I had all of these experiences. And I came away thinking that while it's not my culture and it's not one that I expect to join, it's quite a beautiful culture and it has a lot to be said for it. And I couldn't deny that this world of people united by the use of sign language actually constituted an identity group.
How did that experience remind you of growing up in a family where your parents were not comfortable with your homosexuality?
It seemed very similar to me. Once I learned that most deaf children are born to hearing parents, that those hearing parents really want the kids to function in the hearing world, and that the kids don't usually find much inner peace until they discover the deaf world in adolescence, I thought, it's so similar to what I went through. It's so similar to the way in which I felt as though being gay seemed like this terrible tragedy, and I felt as though my parents just wanted me to be able to function like a normal straight person. And then eventually I began meeting other gay people and getting a sense that there were many people who were gay and seemed to be quite happy being gay and seemed to be having rich and rewarding lives, even though they were gay, and I began to break away from the illness model that my parents had seen that as, and getting to have some sense of the identity one.
It's striking that, and I'm not arguing for a moment that being gay is a flaw, but to the extent that your parents saw it as such, they weren't bothered by the fact that you were dyslexic. In fact, your mother was this like astonishing advocate for your education.
Well, they were bothered by the fact that I was dyslexic, but my mother decided that I had dyslexia and she was determined that I was going to learn to read and write well. And she spent thousands of hours with me, sitting incredibly patiently and working with me on reading and writing. And here I am writing books that worked. But I think the fact that the dyslexia, which was an undesirable quality that she could effectively make go away, at least teach me to function well despite it, that left her with the idea that maybe the homosexuality was also something that she could get under control and cause it to go away. And I feel as though if she had been successful at resolving my gayness and unsuccessful at resolving my dyslexia, I might have an identity as a dyslexic. But as it worked out, it was the dyslexia she could resolve and it was the sexuality that she couldn't. And so I have a sense of gay identity that's been very defining in my adult life.
And from the perspective of a child, no matter how they feel as an adult about their identity, you want to please your parents, right?
Right. And I wanted to please mine. And I really did everything I could. I tried very hard not to be gay. I had girlfriends. I worked on it. But a lot of what I was concerned about, and a lot of, I think, what my parents were concerned about, was not simply that it was somehow socially unacceptable, but that I also thought that one of the great rewards of life would be to have a family. And I was worried I wouldn't be able to have one if I was gay. And I kept thinking, but I want to have kids, but I'm gay. But I want to have kids, but I'm gay. And I felt as though I had to choose which of those two things I was going to prioritize. And I was very frustrated by it. I couldn't figure it out.
And it's interesting, as a person in your 40s now, you're really part of the first generation of gay Americans for whom the choices really are wide open at this point.
The choices are wide open at this point, but I didn't understand that they were wide open when I was a child.
Yeah.
So now I have a husband, we have kids, it's all turned out to be glorious and happy, but it's a life that was unimaginable. I mean, in 1966, when I was 3 years old, Time magazine, that voice of mainstream America, ran an article in which they said, even in purely non-religious terms, homosexuality represents a misuse of the sexual faculty. It is a pathetic little second-rate substitute for reality, a pitiable flight from life that deserves no glamorization or treatment as anything other than a pernicious sickness. So how did we get from there to the point at which the President of the United States just filed an amicus brief at the Supreme Court arguing in favor of gay marriage? How did that happen? And what I thought was, if my condition has shifted so profoundly from being nothing but a pernicious sickness to being something championed by the President of the United States, what other identities can make that shift? What other things we think of as illnesses can move that distance? And in a way, it was trying to see who else could participate in that process that drove the writing of the book.
One conclusion you came to with regard to your mother was that it really, at the end of the day, was not so much that she was trying to control you and your life. She was trying to control her own. And her picture of her own life did not include being the mother of a gay son.
Absolutely. And I think this is one of the things that parents always struggle with. They struggle with the sense in which having a child who's different changes them. So one of the mothers I met who was the mother of a dwarf said to me, you know, I just felt like all of a sudden every time I went out on the street with my child, people were staring at me. I was in this other identity and I felt so uncomfortable with it. And parents of people who are transgender described being so embarrassed. And parents of prodigies even. I wrote about prodigies because I wanted to show that the challenge is difference rather than the challenge being the negative associations with that difference. Even parents of prodigies, it became completely their identity, that this is who they were, this was the child they had produced. It became focal for them. A lot of the time, I think people who have these conditions, and indeed people who don't, conflate the ideas of love and acceptance. Mm-hmm. I used to conflate those ideas. And I think what I found as I worked on the book is that there are many parents who love their children. Indeed, though there are obviously abusive people out there, most parents love their children, but they don't always accept them for who they are. And I realized acceptance is a process and it takes some time. My parents loved me all the way through, but they had some trouble with acceptance.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. We're talking about his book, Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. There's also this issue when a child is born who is different from what parents expected, of simply resetting what the next 18 years will look like, or longer if the child remains dependent on the parents. Can you talk about the different sort of ways that parents talked about processing, coming to terms with the fact that this child was part of their family, this condition, I should say, was part of their family?
A lot of the families found that their whole dynamic was readjusted as they focused themselves around the way in which their child was different. Parents of deaf children had to learn sign language. Parents of dwarfs had to get used to being stared at on the street. Parents of children with autism had to figure out how much the autism in their child could be ameliorated and whether it was a good idea to fix it up. There were all of these shifts that had to take place. A lot of the time we talk about the ways in which the internet has allowed groups of people who have a particular condition to find one another, and it's amazing. If you have high-functioning autism and can use a computer, you get on there and you can find a whole community. There also have emerged, also largely through the internet, though partly through national societies, communities of parents. And a lot of these parents felt like they were dealing with this thing in isolation. One mother of a transgender child said, when someone said to me, oh, your child is transgender, here's a group for transgender, she said, other people go through this? Mm. Other people are dealing with this? So I think we live in a time in which these communities are emerging in a way that they never could before.
The judgment that so many of these families face is really like on top of everything else that they need to cope with. And, you know, families regardless have struggles. But the idea that a lot of people will look at parents and instantly feel that they know the right thing for these families to do has to be a huge burden.
It's a huge burden. There are always intrusive people coming in and giving advice, sometimes giving good advice, sometimes giving not so good advice. I found that there really is a tension between the medical model and the identity model, and that a lot of the time people aren't sure, does my child have an illness or does my child have an identity? And they felt like if it's an illness, then we need to cure it. And if it's an identity, we need to celebrate it. And what I saw, which was perhaps most striking, is that in a lot of these areas, there are advances in both at the same time. Mm-hmm. So deafness is more widely accepted as a culture than it ever was before. There are more and more people who have some awareness of it and who recognize the beauty and eloquence of sign language. And yet the cochlear implant has become more and more prevalent, and so there are fewer and fewer children who are functionally deaf. The implant makes people more or less hearing by bypassing the cochlea. It doesn't work for all forms of deafness, but it does for most of them. So you have that tension. People with Down syndrome, through the changes in educational strategies, are now doing better than they ever did before. A huge number of them are literate. A huge number of them are able to live at least semi-independently. They're also living much longer because there have been advances in treating some of the conditions they have, at the same time that our ability to identify DS early in pregnancy has increased and more people choose to terminate those pregnancies. So I said that I think it's sometimes like that moment in grand opera when the hero realizes he loves the heroine at the exact moment that she dies on the sofa.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University and special advisor on LGBT affairs to the Department of Psychiatry at Yale. His new book is called Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. We'll come back to the conversation in a couple of minutes. If you'd like to be part of it, we have phone lines open at 1-800-933-5372. Or, of course, you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. SMU.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Andrew Solomon is my guest. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell and author of the book Far From the Tree, Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Andrew, we'll get to behavioral questions, and you interviewed families whose children had committed crimes, and we'll talk about that in a moment. But I want to talk about the judgment that exists right now. Judgment exists for parents who choose, if they know during pregnancy that there might be a problem, choose to terminate the pregnancy. And on the other side, there's judgment against parents who choose to have a child who might have what the world sees to be a significant disability.
So the opposition to people terminating those pregnancies is based partly in religious or other beliefs that termination of any pregnancy is wrong. But it also really comes to some extent from communities who define themselves as fetuses who survived and weren't aborted. I felt that a lot of people have an automatic reaction of deciding that they would like to terminate a pregnancy if they have a child who has a difference of some kind. And I think we need for those people to understand what life really is like with a child with those differences. Now, they may still not want to carry to term, and I think that that's their choice. That's my personal position. But I do think a lot of the time people terminate pregnancies with children whom they could have loved, and some, of course, carry to term children who then turn out to be totally overwhelming for them. Anyway, there's opposition both to terminating the pregnancy and at the same time, because children with disabilities are expensive to take care of and some of the cost of taking care of them often devolves to the state, there are a lot of people who think that it's irresponsible not to terminate those pregnancies and feel that parents who choose to carry to term are just imposing on the taxpayer dollar in a way that they shouldn't be doing it. So it's a lose-lose situation, really.
And then families who, have these children, love these children, are trying to make a life with them and sort of deal with the obstacles that come up. Sometimes one of the major hurdles is the sort of sense that everyone around them sees their family and is instantly filled with pity or gratitude that they don't have a child like that. And that's often not the way these families seem to feel.
No, I think a lot of these families have found the experience actually very illuminating and very rewarding. And the book really is about how people who have got children who are different in some way manage to find meaning or construct meaning in the experience. I think, for instance, of Tom and Karen Robards, who had a son with Down syndrome. They were very startled when it happened. They were youngish. They were both hard-charging Wall Street types. And in the years that followed, they felt there weren't good educational facilities for kids with DS, and they got involved in trying to establish a model for better education for those kids. They started with a tiny little center, was in two converted lavatories that they got from the Archdiocese. They eventually built it up into the Cook Center, which has helped really at this point tens of thousands of kids with Down syndrome and set a model for education elsewhere. And I said, do you regret it? Do you wish that your son didn't have Down syndrome? Do you wish this had never happened? And his mother said, well, for David, our son, I regret it because for David, it's a difficult way to be in the world and I'd like to make his life easier. But speaking for ourselves, she said, it's made our lives so much richer and so much more interesting and filled us with so much more purpose than we would have had otherwise that even though I would never have believed 23 years ago when he was born, I would say this, speaking for ourselves, I wouldn't give it up for anything in the world.
Hmm. On the other side of the coin, there are couples who love their children, have done everything for them, but if they knew what was to come, would not make the same choice again.
Absolutely.
And the pain and the guilt of that must be really hard.
I think it is. And I think it's important to recognize that finding the care for someone with disabilities overwhelming and difficult and loving that person are not in opposition. You can love the person and still be very stressed in your life by the needs that that person presents. I had people who said to me, I have this child, I love this child, I take care of this child, and I wouldn't do it over again if I had the choice. And I thought that was a powerful point of view. I was aware, however, that there are lots of families who can't deal with children with disabilities. What was striking to me was how many of them actually went through a phase of thinking, I can't deal with this, I can't do this, it's all too much for me, and then came to be comfortable with it. And I always think of the story of a woman who was in an elevator. Lisa Headley was in an elevator at Johns Hopkins where her daughter, who was a dwarf, was getting treatment. And she was holding her daughter, and there was a woman with a child with Down syndrome standing on the other side of the elevator. And Lisa was just looking at her, and she was thinking, I can deal with mine, but I couldn't deal with yours. And then she looked up at the mother's face and she saw the mother looking at her, and she said, I could tell she was thinking the exact same thing.
Did you think that these families would automatically recognize sort of kindred spirits? And were you surprised that they didn't necessarily?
Well, one of the arguments I've made in the book is that any individual difference can be quite isolating. There aren't that many families dealing with a child with dwarfism. There aren't that many families dealing with a child who commits crimes. There aren't that many families who are dealing with children who are transgender. All of these are areas that can be, you know, they're smallish communities. On the other hand, the idea that all families are dealing with difference of some kind, that's a gigantic idea, and that represents most of humanity. And I found there was so much in common from one of these groups to the other. And in a way, I thought a lot in common with all of us, because I haven't yet met anyone who has children who hasn't occasionally looked at them and thought, where did you come from? and that's really the universal experience I wanted to look at. How do you manage to love a child who's so different? How do you manage to find strength in that adversity?
You sat down with Tom and Sue Klebold, who have not given a lot of interviews. First of all, talk about the conversations that went on ahead of them agreeing to speak with you for this book.
I had given a lecture in Colorado, and one of the organizers mentioned to me that Sue Klebold had been in the audience. And since I was then working on how families respond to children who've committed crimes, I thought she would be an amazing person to interview. And I wrote her a letter. The people who'd organized helped to pass it on. And we had a correspondence that went on for almost 2 years in which I tried to persuade them that it really would be great if they could talk to me. And because she knew my work and because she had come to that lecture, I think they were somewhat more receptive than they might otherwise have been. And then when they finally agreed to tell their story, it seemed to just bubble out of them. They were so full of the story, and they had been so frustrated by the lawsuits that had prevented them from talking to the press for so many years. And I really, somewhat to my surprise, because it wasn't what I expected when I began, I came to love them. I thought they were wonderful people. I thought they seemed like they would have been wonderful parents. You know, we used to blame families for children's gayness. It was overbearing mothers and passive fathers, for their autism, which was caused by refrigerator mothers. Going back further in time, for deafness and dwarfism, which were caused by the mother's unexpressed lascivious longings. I mean, the mother blame game has been going for a long time, and we've gotten over it in all of those areas, and we have not gotten over it in the arena of crime. And I went in with the expectation, which most people seem to have when I talk to them about this, that these people had somehow caused what happened. And I came away thinking it's utterly bewildering, and it was as random that it occurred there as it is when someone's child is born with Down syndrome. It's just what happened.
Do you think, Andrew, we continue to do that, to sort of blame people and assume it must be the parents, because it's that feels like a guarantee that it won't happen to us and to our children?
I do absolutely think that. I think people find these situations very threatening, and I understand why. Because when I started doing this research, I found them very threatening, and I made the sort of counterphobic decision that I was going to rush toward the things that frightened me instead of sitting back away from them. But I think a lot of people like to think, okay, we've done everything right, and so that isn't going to happen in our household. And what I felt as I worked on this, I mean, obviously your child won't come home one day with Down syndrome if your child wasn't born with Down syndrome. But I thought the possibility that your child will evince some profound difference that you'll find alien and difficult to deal with, that can happen to any of us at any time.
So there are identity movements that I think most people would agree are positive and beneficial. Then there are some that are harder to sort of get our minds around, including people who have diagnosed mental illness that is debilitating, incapacitating, that still want to form an identity around that condition and not necessarily accept the world's decision that they ought to be medicating the condition.
Right. So a lot of people who have got illnesses of various kinds find the treatment more onerous than the illness. And the question is in what cases we should indulge them and in what cases we should insist that they have treatment. In the area of schizophrenia, there are some people with untreated schizophrenia who seem to be living very grim and terrible lives, and one tends to think they would be much better off with medication. There are some people, though not so many, who have schizophrenia and become dangerous when they're unmedicated. That becomes a social concern. I think we have to recognize how traumatic and unpleasant some of the treatments that there are out there for mental illness are. But we also have to recognize that people have a pride in the person they believe themselves inherently to be. So Jim Sinclair, who's an adult with autism, said that he felt when people talked about curing autism in their children, that what they really were talking about was a fantasy that someday their autistic child would cease to exist. And as he put it, a stranger you can love would move in behind your child's face. There's a sense that it's so fundamental to people's character. That being said, I feel like our ability to treat these conditions has made progress. And a lot of these conditions are associated with enormous suffering, schizophrenia in particular. And if we could resolve some of that suffering, there's no question we'd be doing a great social good for the larger society and for the individuals.
So parents who have children with a horizontal identity that's different, there's that time when the child is quite young and they're adjusting to this reality they hadn't expected. And then for those who are entirely capable of living independently, there's also got to be an even stronger moment where you break away and realize you're not in charge of decisions anymore that will affect this child's well-being.
Well, I think that's the difficulty for all parents when their children move out of their purview. But one of the issues that came up over and over again with schizophrenia, which tends to first manifest in adolescence or later, is that the parents don't have much time in which to mold the way their child deals with this condition. If you're dealing with Down syndrome, your child is born with Down syndrome, you find out the day your child is born, you have at least 18 years to figure out how to work with that child and how to make everything operate. If your child is suddenly diagnosed with schizophrenia, then things are very, very different. Your child is 17 and you have essentially a year of your child being more or less under your thumb, and then your child has the right to refuse medication and to behave in an extraordinary way. And a lot of the stories that I came across when I was working on that chapter had to do with parents trying over and over again to persuade their children when they no longer had legal authority over them to do things in a somewhat different way. And those parents suffered a lot because they all felt, if I'd only recognized this earlier, if I'd only understood sooner that this is where he was headed, if I'd only managed to get in there earlier. And one of the themes of the book is early intervention. Schizophrenia manifests later, but if you want to help a child who has Down syndrome, get started really early. If you've got a child who's deaf, the signing has to come in right away or else the cochlear implant. If you've got a child who has many of these conditions, you want to, with autism, you want to have the intervention start as early as possible. And the longer you wait to acknowledge what's going on, the less likely you are to get a satisfactory result.
So as many people are aware, good parents who love each other and their kids will argue about whether to push piano lessons or, you know, whether to let a kid play football. What happens when the parents of these children come down on opposite sides of the illness or identity question?
One of the questions that's constantly asked about parenting children with disabilities is whether it brings about a higher divorce rate. There are studies that say it does. There are studies that say that it has a lower divorce rate. There are studies that say it's divorce neutral. It can run the gamut. What I found in my research is that for parents who have a very strong marriage in the first place, the mutual project of dealing with this kind of difficulty can bring them closer together and enforce an even greater intimacy. And for parents whose marriage was not in such great shape in the first place, this is the last straw that actually causes it to fall apart. So I feel like dealing with these kids can go either way. And what you describe, the conflict when one parent wants to go one way and one parent wants to go the other way, It's a pervasive question, and it's a constant problem. Hopefully, they can persuade each other of their positions, and they can come to some kind of resolution. But also, even though we pose these as these opposite things, illness and identity, everybody who's dealing with any of these conditions has to deal with both the illness part of it and the identity part of it. And sometimes it's helpful if one parent is holding on to the identity piece and the other is holding on to the medical piece. They'll make a certain amount of medical progress and they'll teach their child to be proud of who he is. I think both of those things can occur together.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to Sandra in Plano. Hi, Sandra.
Hello. How are you?
Very well. Thank you.
I taught special education for 23 years, and I've had a son with obsessive-compulsive disorder for 25 years. And I think, as everyone knows, you know, Texas is near the bottom as far as mental illness. But I think what I experienced in my teaching and also with our son is the fear of what is going to happen to that child when we're no longer here. And that is really the big worry for parents. I mean, you can take care of them when you're younger, but when you get to be in your 70s and 80s and they're in their 50s, I mean, you start worrying about what's going to happen to you as well as what's going to happen to them. And I just don't think that's something that we've addressed. I mean, there's programs, but they're small and, you know, just sort of in between. And I have not read your book, but I certainly will. But I was wondering if anywhere in your book or anywhere in your experience you could address that particular issue.
Well, that's really a central issue all the way through the book, and I try to address it over and over again in these different communities. The first problem is that in most states, services run through about the age of 21. It varies a little from state to state. And then parents have to figure out when their child turns 21, this child still has disabilities and still has challenges. What is the child going to do all day? How are you going to keep the child occupied? How are you going to give the child a life of some description? So that's the first challenge. But then there's the question of, should I put my child in an institution or keep my child at home? Well, keeping your child at home often results in a more loving atmosphere for that child. On the other hand, if you keep your child at home until you become completely infirm or until you've died, then when you die, the child has to make the transition not only of not having a loving parent there, but also of how to go about life in an institution, moving to a new place, completely disrupted, and that's terribly traumatic. So a lot of the families I talk to place their children, even though they would have liked to keep them at home, because they wanted to be able to help their child with the transition to living in a new place and make sure he was used to it when something eventually happened to the parents. But when do you do that? And as you've said, Texas is not as strong as some other states in providing decent institutions for people to go to. How do you find the institution? How do you get the kids set up there? It's a big challenge.
My guest is Andrew Solomon. He's a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell and special advisor on LGBT affairs to the Department of Psychiatry at Yale. His new book is called Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can give your kids or grandkids a creative and educational experience this summer at SMU in Plano. smu.edu/CAPE Summer Youth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Andrew Solomon about his new book, Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. You can join us at 1-800-933-5372, and that's where we find Tressa in Dallas. Hello, Tressa.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. I'm a little bit nervous. It's quite an honor to speak with you, Mr. Solomon. You're a beautiful writer and obviously brilliant. I'm in the middle of this book right now, and I just wanted to thank you for writing it. My husband and I adopted a baby when he was very young, and he's 2 now. While he's been with us for most of his life, he's fun, he's beautiful, he's a sweet spirit. He is very different from me. As a full-time mom who struggles with doing what's best for my child, pushing him in different directions or what I think is right, but wanting to celebrate his differences, this book has been just an invaluable resource and encouragement. You kind of quote-unquote expose so many issues that parents quote-unquote don't talk about, and it's been just a great comfort. And I literally recommend this book to every person I talk to in the course of a day. So just wanted to call and thank you for writing it.
Well, thank you so much. What a lovely, lovely call. You've made my day.
You must hear from people. The book's been out for a couple months now. Are you surprised at the responses that you've received from people?
I'm overwhelmed by the responses that I've received from people. It's been both glorious and difficult. Glorious because it's lovely to know that I'm actually reaching people. And when someone like The Last Caller has those kind things to say, it really means the world to me. It makes me feel 11 years working on the book was all worth it. But a lot of people are getting in touch with me to tell me their painful stories. I welcome those people. I can be reached on my website at andrewsolomon.com, and I'm always glad to hear from everyone. But there are days when I get 20 or 30 very difficult and sad stories coming in, and I feel like the sadness of the world sometimes weighs heavy on me. I mean, I also get many stories of triumph and parents saying, I had this child and it's been really difficult, but I've ended up thinking it was the best experience of my life. But all of these stories, even if they have an ultimate resolution in joy, have to transit through a great deal of pain. And even when the joy is there, you know, as the Robard said, we wish for our son we could fix it because for him it's a hard way to be in the world. So I'm thrilled with the response, but also sometimes, yeah, overwhelmed by it.
It's an interesting reflection on the limitations of the powers that parents have. We want to believe that we can do everything to make things right for our children. And there are some things we can't fix.
Right. And the question is whether we do better in those instances if we at some point say, we aren't going to fix this and we'll stop. So I had a friend who had cancer of the jaw and she had a very badly deformed face. And through her childhood and adolescence and on into her 20s, she kept having surgeries to try to reconstruct her jaw, and none of them worked, and she was in a state of despair about it. And I thought, okay, if someone had said when she was little, you don't have a jaw, this is your face, see if you can come to terms with it, I think she would have had so much better a life. I think all of the time spent working on fixing it and failing to have it happen actually was what destroyed her life, and she died a tragic death very young of an overdose. So I think we have to be cautious. We have to be cautious about what we fix. We have to be open to fixing some things. We have to be open to accepting some things.
So there can be a sharper side to hope than people might realize.
I think a lot of what one experiences in hope is the hope that the larger society will accept the child one has. It's for that child who has some form of difference to hope for acceptance. And I'd like to think we're constructing a more accepting world. There's always the issue of mainstreaming, which is taking people who've got disabilities and differences and educating them in the same classroom with children who don't. Now, I think before I started on this book, I would have thought, I want my kids to learn as much as possible, as fast as possible, and I don't want them to be in a situation in which they're being slowed down by someone with differences. Now, I think not only is it good for the people with differences to be in a mainstream classroom at least some of the time so that they're functioning in the larger world, it's also really good for the other kids in that classroom to be interacting every day with somebody who's different and seeing what that difference looks like and maybe becoming less uncomfortable with it. So I hope that in an era of mainstreaming, bit by bit, we'll create a kinder, more tolerant society.
How did all this play into your decision to become a parent?
So I had so many people say to me, how could you decide to become a father in the middle of writing a book about everything that can go wrong? Mm-hmm. And I have to keep saying that I decided to have children in the middle of writing a book about how much love and joy there can be even when things go wrong. It was the strength of these parents that was such an inspiration. But I'm married to my husband. He is the biological father of two children with some lesbian friends in Minneapolis. One of my closest friends from college, a very beloved friend who lives in Fort Worth, and I had a conversation about how much we both wanted children and decided to have a child. And so we have a daughter in Fort Worth whom I adore more than I can ever say. And then John and I decided we'd like to have a child to bring up at home with us. And so we decided to have our son, George. I'm the biological father, and Laura, one of the women in the lesbian couple in Minneapolis, it was our surrogate. So the shorthand
is... So for anyone without a piece of paper in front of them.
Indeed. the shorthand is five parents of four kids in three states. And when I was little, my mother always said, oh, the love for your children is unlike anything else in the world. And people who don't have children never get to know. And it used to make me mad when she said that once I'd said I was gay because I thought I wouldn't have children and I didn't want it to be said to me over and over again. But she did say it to me over and over again and it stuck in my mind and it's part of what drove me toward having children. And as it turns out, she was right.
Did you have the same worries that we all have, that your the son that you and your husband are bringing up at your home would not be sort of, air quotes, perfect in the way that you imagine he might be?
I think working on this book had given me a very different relationship to that idea of perfection. The day after he was born, we were told in the hospital that he was not extending his legs correctly and that they thought that might be a sign of brain damage and that we had to take him down for an MRI. And it was a very frightening experience, taking him down, putting him in that machine, standing there while they examined him to see what was wrong. By the end of the day, he was extending his legs just fine, and it turned out he was fine. But I had found myself in that moment of thinking, here I've written this whole book about embracing people with difference, and I'm really worried at the idea that I'm going to become one of the people who has to do that. It was a very humbling experience. But I also felt in a way that I don't think I would have before I wrote this book. I thought, even if our son turns out to be brain damaged, I think I'm going to be able to love him anyway. And I feel as though part of what I've learned from the book is that there are many kinds of perfection and that he doesn't need to be, my children don't need to be perfect the way I am, which doesn't mean that I don't endlessly, you know, gently push them toward things that I believe in and try to help them be what seems to me to be their best selves. But I think I'm prepared to love them for who they are. I hope so anyway. I know it's important to do it.
It's interesting on the question, you know, your son could grow up to be straight, he could grow up to be gay. And I would think in some ways, as a gay man brought up by straight parents, you have an exposure to sort of both cultures that your parents didn't benefit from in raising you.
I think I do have an exposure to both of those. I don't see any evidence that any of the kids are growing up to be gay. But I think your kids always present a challenge you didn't expect. You know, if you're someone who could really deal with having a gay kid, your kid won't be gay. He'll be, I don't know, a criminal, or he'll be transgender, or he'll be something else that pushes you further out of your comfort zone. So I'll be totally fine if the kids are gay. I'm totally delighted if they aren't gay. I imagine that there'll be something that I find hard to deal with, and I don't know yet what it is.
Do you think the day will come, maybe when their grandchildren are walking around, when that's just not an issue? It's just a fact of life, like you have blue eyes and I have green eyes, and we can be friends.
I think we're headed in that direction. I think there will always be pockets of people who are very homophobic, in the same way that there are pockets of people who are still terribly racist or terribly anti-Semitic. I think hatred doesn't die out of the human race. It'll always be there. But I hope that that will be the case. And, you know, you mentioned that I'm involved in the School of Psychiatry at Yale, and Larry Kramer, who set up the initiative for lesbian and gay people at Yale, was there in the 1950s. And when he describes what it was like to be gay at Yale then, I think, I don't know how he survived it, and I'm not sure I could have gotten through. I might have killed myself. I then think I was at school there in the 1980s, and I had a basically fine experience. But I look at the kids who are there now, and I think, oh, they know they can marry someone and have a family. And I'm envious of them. And what I always say to them is that I hope when they're my age and they're coming back, they'll be as envious of the next generation as I am of them.
Did any of this, as a parent now, did you give any thought to, you know, when this is sort of on the flip side and perhaps you are elderly and in the care of one or more of your children?
I have thought about that a certain amount. It's interesting. Human beings are the only species in which we expect that reciprocity, in which we assume that our children will someday take care of us. You know, my children are very little now, so I don't have a real sense of their doing that, but they're both sweet and caretaking types. And to some extent, you know, I've talked about how difficult it is to have children who are different. My children are going to have to deal with what it's like to have a parent who's somewhat different and to come from a family structure that's not a completely conventional mainstream family structure. And I hope I can help them through that. And I hope that when we're older, it'll be a happy relationship among all of us. So,
what do you think are the lessons in this for parents who pick up this book and don't relate specifically to the issues that you deal with here, whose kids are neurotypical, who don't appear to be any different?
I think the message is that your child is a separate person from you, that you have to understand that, and you have to figure out in what areas to be accepting of your child's differences, even if they're very small differences, and that love involves not only adoring but also seeing your child for who your child is. So one of the things I come up against over and over again is parents who are in some sense denying or trying to repress, you know, well, my child has Down syndrome, but we're going to make him function like everyone else. We're going to have cosmetic surgery so he doesn't look like he has Down syndrome. We're going to try to change him, you know, sometimes very forcibly. And I feel like a lot of the book is just about the idea that love involves seeing your child for who he is and making the most of who he is.
Do you think our generation of parents is more narcissistic than other generations of parents?
I think narcissism has been around for a long time, mm-hmm. but I think we live in an era in which there's a lot of confusion about the value of raising children. You know, I'm always struck by the idea that women who have had a child and have had a maternity leave either go back to work or they stay at home. And stay at home always sounds in that construction like a little casual thing they're doing. I feel like staying at home and taking care of your kids full time is a gigantic job. And I feel like we've lost a certain amount of respect for it. And in losing respect for how difficult the life is of mothers, even of typical children, much less of the extraordinary children I've been writing about, in losing sight of that, we somehow have made motherhood seem insignificant. And women often seem to be narcissistic because they're responding to that social imperative and feel like they have to work, they have to justify themselves beyond being mothers.
Sort of prove that they're that it's worth the time that they're investing.
Exactly.
Were there families that you talked to that you could empathize with but really found yourself disagreeing with in ways that made it difficult to like them, to fully understand them?
There were definitely some whom I found difficult to understand. There were some who I thought were not doing so well by their children. And there were many who just humbled me with their conviction. I mean, you asked me earlier about the Klebolds, and Sue Klebold said at one point, I used to wish that I had never gone to Ohio State. I had never met Tom. We had never had this child. Our child was one of the perpetrators of the Columbine massacre. She said, but I've decided that I love the children I had so much that even with this awfulness, I wouldn't want to imagine a life without them. So while I recognize it would have been better for the world if Dylan had never been born, I've decided it would not have been better for me. And I sort of thought, that's crazy. Of course it would have been better for you. It would have been better for you not to go through this. It's been the most agonizing experience of your life, and it will never end. But I also think that meaning is something that you build. It's not just something that's inherently there. You decide you're going to look at this challenge and find strength in it. You decide it's going to help you to grow and to become a better person. That's a real decision. And so there were families who had made that decision, and I thought, gee, I wouldn't be able to make it under those circumstances, or I'm not completely convinced by it, or all kinds of other kind of concerns and reservations. But I ended up thinking, but if they've found the meaning and if they've discovered that way of being with someone who presents unusual challenges, then I think I have to take my hat off to them and say, it's amazing you could do it. I couldn't do it in this particular circumstance, but how great that you did.
Andrew Solomon is a lecturer in psychiatry at Cornell University and special advisor on LGBT affairs to the Department of Psychiatry at Yale. His new book is called Far From the Tree: Parents, Children, and the Search for Identity. Andrew, it's been wonderful. Thank you so much for joining us.
It's been glorious. Thank you so much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect answered the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. Jeff Whittington is senior producer. You can learn more about the show and download the podcast free at kera.org/think. And we always welcome your comments, questions, and suggestions emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.